Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Maurice Ruett. Maurice, how are you today?
Good afternoon, Nicholas. I'm right, and you?
Yeah, no, I'm all right. I'm all right. And Miss Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you?
Hi. Nick. Good. Nice, lovely, warm day.
Yes, it is, rather. But not for me in my blanket fort studio, where it is a little bit on the uncomfortable side of hot. I'd just like to wish our colleagues who are going to Senegal today and will be there tomorrow for the sort of court drama and all that sort of thing, good luck. And you can listen to why we're going there in a podcast we did yesterday, a campaigns update podcast. Anyway, I would like to move on to our first story, and this is a foreign affairs story, and that New Zealand is having an election on Saturday. They're having a general election. And it looks like the current incumbent Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, keep mispronouncing her name, but anyway, is on track to win a second term as Prime Minister. Her popularity seems to have gone up since she led efforts to stamp out coronavirus. She's been praised by a lot of people in New Zealand for that, although people overseas have been somewhat more skeptical of her. Her party was doing is the Labour Party, and was actually behind the Conservative National Party 2 years ago, and last year as well. But since the beginning of the year, its popularity has soared, and it looks like she's going to do pretty well in this election. Her background is she grew up in a rural area in New Zealand. Her dad was a police officer. Her mom was a school cook. She joined the Labour Party at 18 and worked as an advisor to the Labour Prime Minister at the time. And she became a lawmaker in 2008. She's basically been a sort of a political figure her entire life. New Zealand has a proportional voting system, which means that no party has ever managed to, in the 24 years since they've had the system, has managed to win an election outright with 50%. It's a bit like South Africa, except they don't have a dominant ruling party there. And so her party will probably have to form a coalition. However, the Green Party in New Zealand and the New Zealand First Party, which is a sort of populist party, supported her last time. But it remains to be seen whether she will get enough, perhaps even to form a government without their help. So, Maurice, let's go to you, because of the three of us, I think you're the one who's the most knowledgeable about New Zealand. Do you think that these early indications are that they're right about who's going to win the New Zealand election? And is there anything interesting you want to tell us about New Zealand's elections?
Yeah, well, I mean, the polls from what I've read seem to be pretty accurate in New Zealand. One of the things that's quite interesting in New Zealand, that a party needs to get 5% of the vote or to win at least one constituency. Because in New Zealand, half these parliamentary seats are decided by proportional representation, the other half from constituencies. So if you don't get that 5% or if you don't win at least one constituency, you don't get into parliament, which quite a few countries actually have that threshold. And I've always thought about if we had it in South Africa, we'd probably only at the moment have three parties in parliament instead of the 14 we do, which is actually quite interesting to think about.
Our smallest party got, I think, 0.19% of the votes or something?
Yeah, or 1.18 in Al Jamaa. I think that's it. That's the Muslim party from the Western Cape. I think it seems pretty accurate, and it'll be quite an achievement by Jacinda Ardern if she manages to get over 50% of the vote, especially considering in 2017, the last time New Zealand had an election, her party only won 36% of the vote. So they've done pretty well. But it's also partly because the main opposition, the National Party, has been pretty chaotic. They're on their third leader in 2020 alone. So they had a guy who was overthrown in May, I think. And then the new guy called Todd Muller, he was only leader for about a month. And then he decided it's not ready for him. And then a woman called Judith Butler has taken over. So she's the biggest challenger to Jacinda Ardern. But yeah, so it's probably quite likely that Jacinda Ardern is probably going to have to govern in coalition with the Greens. That's probably the most likely outcome. But who knows, there's another party that seems to be doing quite well, the ACT party, which is sort of a classically liberal party. And they only won one seat in the last election, but looking at polling, they're getting about 6 to 7% of the vote. So it's quite a big improvement for them. And who knows, I mean, they could maybe be part of a government, but just from what I've read, it seems that Labour and ACT are don't really get on with each other. But something that's probably most interesting for South Africans, it's something that's been going around on Twitter. So there's a guy called Martin Frauenstein, who's running for a party called the New Conservative Party in a constituency called Otaki, which is in the south of North Island. But anyway, he's a South African, or an old South African, and on his campaign poster, he calls himself an apartheid survivor, and also talks about how he's going to try and restrict immigration to New Zealand. So people have been rightly pointing out, what does an apartheid survivor mean as a white South African, unless you were actually opposed to the old government, and if you're, you know, like in jail or whatever, you probably wasn't that difficult to survive apartheid, really. So I mean, I was 11 when apartheid ended, and I didn't really have to survive it. So, and it's also you got to ask yourself, when a guy is an immigrant himself, then he's joining a party that's anti-immigration. So I don't know. It's just people have raised some eyebrows about this guy, but his party, this New Conservative Party, they're only polling at between 1 and 2%. And as I said, you need about at least 5% to get into the New Zealand Parliament. So Kiwis are probably going to be spared from having to deal with this guy in their Parliament.
Yeah, one of the things I think when we last talked about New Zealand on the show was actually that they had postponed their election because of coronavirus concerns. And I think that shocked a lot of people, because postponing elections is usually not done unless there's some sort of huge crisis. And I think they also followed a bit of a lockdown that was extremely strict. I think as strict as South Africa, if not stricter, at least for a few weeks when they had a little spike in cases, even though New Zealand has managed to, for the most part, it seems, kind of avoid the ravages of COVID. But for these reasons and other ones to do with the Prime Minister's dislike of firearms and the rights to own weapons, she's not very popular with the right internationally. I know that she's a... Yeah, she's cracked down on a lot of things that people consider important freedoms. Sara, what do you make of her? What do you make of this New Zealand election?
Well, if you can get past her absolutely appalling Kiwi accent, which, it just sears through my brain when I hear her, I think she's very much a sort of committed left-wing politician, as any good Labour politician should be. And I think it was relatively easy to enact a hard lockdown in New Zealand, because it really is a set of islands. So barring entry could be done immediately, very quickly. And I think you said it was a hard lockdown, and I think they kept it hard for long enough, and hard enough for there literally to be pretty much a handful of cases. And I think that's gone down well. And I think I get the impression that the New Zealand, because New Zealand is a prosperous country, it's now doing really, really well, and standards of living have risen. People are sort of more tolerant of having their freedoms a bit tramped upon. As you said, there was a lot of criticism of her postponing the election, but I don't get the impression that's going to have an impact on the actual vote when it happens. I think the problem will probably come some way down the line for her, because at some point they're going to have to open their borders, and because they've let nothing in and they've had a low infection and death rate, the disease is coming for them, because this is not a sort of 6 month or 1 year wonder. It's a viral disease that is likely to be around for the next 2 years at least. So they might have postponed very happily something that is going to come down the track at them. But I think, as I say, right now, she's been decisive. She's looked confident in what she's decided, what she said. She's battered away the concern about cutting people's rights by postponing the election. So I suspect things are good for her, but I'm not convinced that that it necessarily will take her all the way to the end of the next term.
Morris?
Yeah, I think I just want to echo Sarah's point. It's quite easy to deal with coronavirus if you're a small island that's very isolated and has got a and is highly developed and has quite a prosperous population. I mean, other island countries have done pretty well as well. Mauritius and Iceland have both done pretty well with handling COVID-19. Taiwan's even, I mean, they're a good example. They had a lot of traffic from China, for example. But anyway, I mean, it just shows you that's like Jacinda Ardern's got a lot of praise for her handling of COVID, and it's probably a lot of it's valid, but it's also a lot easier to keep COVID out if you are an island compared to a place like South Africa. But another point, though, and sorry, is also you're quite right to, they're going to have to deal with COVID at some point. And if they haven't dealt with it and people haven't built up immunity and so on, I mean, you could maybe wait for a vaccine, but that's probably at least 6 months to 2 years away. So it's an issue for people still to wait for. And what I've read is that apparently the virus that caused the Spanish flu is still actually around, but it's just people have built up an immunity to it and it's degraded so much humans can fight it off pretty easily now.
Yeah.
So the COVID-19 virus is probably going to be with us for the next 100 years even. But yeah. I mean, obviously it'll be much weaker and our bodies will recognize it to fight it off.
Sure. No, exactly. I mean, the virus does weaken over time, but lots of viruses don't die out altogether, as you correctly say. So, you know, I wouldn't make too many predictions about COVID in New Zealand. I think it could unravel because there's almost no herd immunity.
Well, we will have to see. I tend to be a bit of an optimist actually up on the vaccine front. I think that we probably will have one fairly early into next year, and so. It may pay off them. New Zealand's only had 1,800 cases and 25 deaths, which is.
So you're happy to get Bill Gates' chip put into you?
Yeah, you know, they already know where I am because of my cell phone.
Can our listeners, just to make it clear, I was joking. I don't think Bill Gates was.
Can I just say a little thing about the South African? We've seen people of this ilk before emigrating somewhere and then declaring that they're a victim. Usually they are sort of fairly white, right wing. One could probably question their non-racial credentials, and they double down, you know, by saying, well, it's okay for me that New Zealand me in, but it's not okay for thee. Mm-hmm. Fairly kind of common personality type, shall we say.
I think my last question on this is going to be to you, Sarah, and that's, you know, New Zealand has gone for a hard lockdown approach, and actually in a lot of countries where we've seen very hard lockdowns, even as there's been economic damage that's followed, the popularity of the politicians behind the lockdowns has normally gone up. Not in every case. Mm-hmm. I think the UK is an example where that's not true. But arguably one of the reasons that Joe Biden is ahead of Trump in the American polls is because he's more in favor of lockdowns. And I think this is something that we as anti-lockdown people have to kind of grapple with, which is that it seems that in most cases, the electoral incentives are for politicians to lock down harder rather than softer. What do you make of that, Sarah?
I think there's a point to that, in the fact that I think, you know, by and large, the West as an entity has become fairly soft. We've had decades of prosperity, comfort and safety. And I think a lot of the reaction, even in England, where it's now sort of teetering a bit, a lot of it is fears of the unknown. And so here's a figure who takes control, and that control involves ostensibly keeping you as safe as possible.
Indeed. But anyway, I think we're going to see the political consequences of this for a long time to come. And we will have to see what the results of New Zealand's election are. Maybe the ACT will surprise, and Labour won't do as well as is predicted. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And this is a bit of a double-barreled corruption story. Two separate scandals, but both kind of coming out at the same time. The first is that the Zondo Commission received a letter from senior bureaucrats in the Department of International Affairs, which wrote to them to say that the appointment of ambassadors and diplomats is in many cases completely tainted by kickbacks and bribes, And that many ambassadors are simply in the place because they buy their ambassadorships. And I think this is a pretty clear point. I mean, the ANC has been very, you know, I think it's used ambassadorships as a very powerful patronage tool. Of course, I think South Africa has one of the highest numbers of diplomats in the world. I think only behind the United States, actually, in terms of numbers of consulates. And then a completely unrelated corruption story, or at least unrelated in the details, which is that the Special Investigating Unit has referred over 5,500 ESCOM officials for disciplinary proceedings for dishonest dealings. The majority of them are for failing to declare their interests to the company. Investigations have revealed that over 300 officials are linked to entities that do business with ESCOM, and contracts worth 6 billion rand can be traced to 135 ESCOM officials. It's also uncovered 44 million rand in kickbacks paid to four ESCOM employees by contractors involved in building the Kusile power station. So, sorry, let's go to you. Firstly, do you think I'm right about the patronage points of the ambassadorships? And second, I think... you know, perhaps we may have worked out why ESCOM is not doing so hot at the moment.
Well, it does certainly explain why the country has no money, because our taxes have essentially disappeared. The ESCOM kind of surprises but doesn't surprise. It's just that the scale is impressive, but the facts, the allegations are not. It's the kind of what we expect. So it's I think about 13% of the workforce. Well, I mean, that's really a thought. With regard to the ambassadors, that's actually almost a funny story, because I think the one ambassador said that, you know, they would be required to institute debit orders straight to the ANC every month for their ambassadorships. Now, I mean, you've got to kind of admire the brazenness of it. Doesn't even come through. It's not going to the tax coffers. It doesn't go to the treasury. It goes straight to the ANC. So it literally is ANC patronage. I mean, it's like 1 + 1 = 2. And what I'm really almost impressed by is the sheer imagination, level of imagination required to find ways to elicit money illegally, unlawfully, unfairly, whatever it may be. That, if it were an industry, South Africa would be in much better shape.
Indeed. Morris, I think, you know, we've talked a bit about it before, about how difficult it's going to be for even a very determined president, which it's not clear that Ramaphosa actually is, to root out corruption, because it's in every single institution. The biggest state-owned enterprise, the Foreign Services Corps. Is this yet more evidence of that problem?
Yeah, I think so. It just shows how institutionalized corruption is. I mean, luckily, at least in my experience, we haven't got to the point where you have to pay bribes to get just the service. You know, you don't have to pay 100 bucks extra to get your car license, for example. But I wouldn't be surprised in 5 or 10 years' time, corruption has become even so further institutionalized that is the case. I remember, actually, just as an aside, I remember reading an interesting story from India a couple of years ago where people were getting issued zero rupee notes. So the face value was zero, and people were encouraged to use that to pay bribes. So that's maybe that'll end up happening in South Africa. But I think also just the issue of the foreign services just shows, I think also hollowing out of institutions. I mean, as you say, it was just used as an ANC patronage tool. And, you know, politicians were pretty much failed politicians, were given plum postings. I mean, Ebrahim Rasool comes to mind, who basically, you know, led the Western Cape, you know, led it like a drunk driver. And, I mean, then you got a post to Washington.
Zinzi Mandela.
Zinzi Mandela. I mean, the USA, I would imagine, is probably the most plum posting for any diplomat. You know, but it's probably that, London and Paris, I suppose, maybe Beijing these days. But also, I read Tony Leon's book about his experiences when he was ambassador to Argentina. And I remember he was saying he, you know, out these papers about what South Africa can do to get more trade with Argentina, and these are the gaps South African companies can take, and send off these long tomes to Victoria and never get a reply. You know, so you got to think this is probably the case. I mean, foreign, and I've heard other stories. Apparently, before the World Cup in Japan last year. All the countries that were playing in the World Cup had a little stand, you know, to tell people about the country and, you know, why they should come. Apparently, the South African stand wasn't manned. Nobody was there. And I remember that this is why I read about it. Some a fan who was there for the games, you know, wandering around, and he took it on himself to man the stand. And then he was telling, you know, just a random rugby fan is telling people about how wonderful South Africa is. But it shows you, I mean, you know, and nobody can even be bothered to go there. And I would imagine that every other country that sends a team to the World Cup is probably there and, you know, promoting the country and talking about the tourism and investment opportunities and so on. So, I mean, it's just it's also a symptom of the hollowing out of the state and South African institutions, which is a problem for all of us.
Can I just say, with regard to manning these sort of important postings, I mean, I think since Zuma's time, it didn't start off terribly well, but certainly since Zuma's time, the sort of people that have been put in very important postings, I mean, they wouldn't know diplomacy if it kicked them in the butt. They have no skills, no experience, and you need very experienced diplomats. It's a distinct art form to deal with diplomacy. And we've got, oh God, we've had really dreadful people just going there as if it's their right.
Indeed, I remember reading a story, I think relatively recently, that and I may be slightly wrong on the details here, but I think it was the South African consulate in Germany did not actually have more than one or two German speakers, and as a result, it could barely function. Mm.
I think our colleague Terence Corrigan put it out, and he said there wasn't one German speaker there.
There wasn't one German speaker. That's quite terrifying. And of course, some of our other ambassadors have tried to get us into a lot of trouble, like the one that said that we would militarily intervene to protect Venezuela from the United States. That was a comment made in 2013, I think.
I think the story now about the ambassador to Sudan is apparently involved in some murder plot. I don't know the details, but I was too depressed to read the article. It seems our Sudanese ambassador is planning to kill someone.
And the henchman he hired actually killed and mutilated two women as practice.
It's terrible. Jeez, and these people are supposed to be our best, representing us overseas.
I wonder if someone did sort of what is the percentage of South Africans that are involved in criminal activity and then compared it to the percentage of the diplomatic corps who are involved in criminal activity. I suspect it would be a majority of the diplomatic corps, unfortunately. And of course, you know, we've got these two corruption stories, yet more bad news about ESCOM's mismanagement, and also how, you know, our diplomatic corps is being sort of sold out for political patronage. And Maurice, you actually just linked a tweet which said that the number of assessed taxpayers in South Africa has dropped from 6.2 million in 2012 to 4.9 million in 2018, and probably a fair number since then, actually. Because
especially with the lockdown stuff and economic decline even since 2018.
COVID and immigration, all that sort of thing. So, Sarah, this seems to just be more evidence that having sort of, firstly, the state's capacity is shot, and secondly, there's no money, that doing a state-led approach to economic development is really, really not going to work, isn't it?
It's actually probably very depressing, because you don't need a learned economist to tell the government what they need to do to get the economy on track. But the government persists in this sort of government-led high expenditure process with the infrastructure build at the top of it without money. And you kind of wonder, well, you know, where's it going to look for it? Because, you know, the IMF is probably a little bit antsy at the moment about the direction that the ANC is going in, and the EWC bill will not have made anyone feel more comfortable. So it's like, it looks like we're going to have to vote out the ANC to change things.
Indeed. And I think the president is actually revealing his economic development plan today to a joint sitting of parliament. So by the time you hear this, that'll probably be coming out, and we will examine the first details of that next week. Mm. Anyway,
all indications are that it's not going to be so good.
Yeah.
But let's give them the benefit of the doubt, see what they do come up with. Maybe there will be some things in there that are a step in the right direction. We shall have to see.
Sweet summer child, Nick.
All right, let's move overseas again to the big international story in the U.S., which is that the vacancy left in the United States Supreme Court by Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is looking to be filled by a Republican-nominated judge, Amy Coney Barrett, who is famous for having seven children, two of whom were adopted, five children biologically, one of whom has Down syndrome. She's also a accomplished law professor from Notre Dame University in the U.S., or Notre Dame, as the Americans pronounce it. And she has been a federal court judge for, I think, 3 years now, and she's just been nominated to the Supreme Court by Trump. Democratic senators have attacked her on a number of interesting points. Previously, she was attacked when she was went through her previous hearing to become a federal court judge. There were some dodgy attacks that kind of looked like it was the Democrats attacking her religion, because she's a very devout Catholic. However, since the public relations disaster of that, the Democrats have really honed and focused their criticism on her to be about how she might rule on a case of, regarding the Affordable Care Act, more popularly known as Obamacare, which is important to the American healthcare system, or at least is very strongly supported by Democrats. Sarah, what do you make of the Supreme Court hearing? What do you make of Amy Coney Barrett? And what do you think of the Democrats' tactic here?
Yeah. I don't know whether this tactic will succeed or will look bad for the Democrats, but it's an awful one. I mean, essentially what they've been attacking her on, and you've seen Democratic questioners, senators, say that she is going to overturn Obamacare. Now, what they appear to be doing is not putting much explanation behind the fact that no one can overturn Obamacare. Certainly the court can't overturn Obamacare. First of all, a case has to come before them on Obamacare, and then the issue that the court is obliged to deal with is whether the act is constitutional or not. That's their mandate. They can't, unless they do declare it unconstitutional, they can't do anything else with Obamacare. So they're trying to give the impression that because of her conservative position, that she's going to overturn Obamacare, and they're punting this quite openly, and it's disingenuous, but maybe they'll get away with it. And it's got a very sort of nasty quality about it, because it's frankly it's dishonest. It's not dealing with any of the real issues. My impression, I haven't watched all that much, so I can't form a solid impression, but she seems quite a dignified woman, and I suspect she has to be very bright to be in the position she's in. And then, of course, there's the other thing with regard to her, is the Democrats saying, well, we're going to she's being considered under an illegal process. They're trying to create the impression that because this is happening before the election, not after it, the process is illegal, and that the Republicans have paid no attention to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's last dying wish that this matter should be dealt with after the election. I mean, that is absolute hooey. Whatever wish she may have had, and I don't know whether she had any such wish, it has absolutely nothing to do with the price of eggs. And the Republicans, whether you like them or agree with them or not, are entitled to follow the procedure they're following. So, as I say, they're trying to cast this whole sense of irrationality, conservatism, high religious belief, and illegality, and none of it is actually relevant to the issue.
Yeah, one of the case I think that they've mostly been referring to here, that they're worried of how she will vote, is some case that the Trump administration is involved in, which might overturn aspects of the Obamacare. However, legal scholars widely believe that the case has very little merits, and even the conservative justices on the court are likely to decide strongly against. So even if she was put on the court, it's very unlikely, I think, that she would do this. It's probably a much cleverer tactic to go after how she might vote on healthcare rather than on her religion, which is how it was previously.
Can I just say, absolutely, because when you attack somebody on the basis of religion, you're really going into territory that you could be embarrassed by. But Obamacare's got an emotional quality. That's religion.
Indeed. And also, I think Americans generally are, you know, unhappy with a lot of aspects of their healthcare system. Because, of course, medication is very expensive there for very complicated reasons that I don't think anyone actually fully understands unless you're a super expert. So any more changes to that system, and Obamacare was already quite a big change, I think it makes a lot of Americans very nervous that they might lose access to the good quality healthcare they have in that country. Anyway, I think that's probably all we have time for today. So thank you very much for listening. If you like the podcast, please leave us a review. Please also subscribe to us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or iTunes if you are listening to the show on the Daily Friend website right now. Also, you can become a friend of the Institute of Race Relations if you go to our website, irr.org.za, and click the Join Us button. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week with more news and analysis. Keep the flag of liberty flying, and stay fresh, everyone.